and thank you for listening to the Skeptics in the Pub online podcast. This unedited audio is taken from 100 Seconds to Midnight, Skepticism and Existential Threats in the Age of Fake News by Andrew Torres, and first broadcast live on the 23rd of July, 2020. A video recording of this and many other talks hosted by Skeptics in the Pub online are still available on our YouTube channel. We hope you enjoy this podcast and thank you for your support.
Oh, thank you so much. I want to thank Michael Marshall. I want to thank the Merseyside Skeptic Society and Skeptics in the Pub online for inviting me here, at least virtually. And it's in the afternoon in the States, but I am joining you here in the pub, and I'm pleased to do so. And of course, I want to thank Emma McClure, who's not only an amazing host, but was an amazing guest on my show. That was episode 321. So go check her out. And in fact, if you are a regular show listener, you might remember last time I gave a speech like this to an international audience. It was a rollicking good time. We got to talk about complete nutters, people who are called sovereign citizens in my country. And they go by the much cooler name of free men on the land in yours. They are delightfully mad, somewhat less delightfully anti-Semitic. And we got to make fun of them for about an hour, and it was delightful. Some of you may be expecting a similar speech here today. And if that's you, you're going to be disappointed. In fact, I have to confess that I've lured you here under somewhat false pretenses. I really am happy that I was able to work the phrase existential threats into the title, but Marsh would not let me call this what I wanted to call it, which you will see on the screen. We're all going to die, and probably not from COVID-19. But before I can tell you about how we're all going to die, you know you're getting a speech from a lawyer, so here are the mandatory disclaimers. Skeptics in the Pub Online is a coalition of UK-based skeptic groups working to deliver online events focusing on science, reasoning, and critical thinking. Nothing in the speech is or is intended to advocate on behalf of or in opposition to any political campaign or any candidate for public office in any country. And, of course, nothing in the speech constitutes legal advice or creates an attorney-client relationship in any country. Don't take legal advice from this speech. Oh, and the puppy is up there for three reasons. First, a lot of you listen to my show, and that is indeed Lily, the opening arguments puppy, who turned 8 this week. Second, I am not about to be upstaged by Adam Rutherford. And third, I really am going to scare the hell out of you. So before I do that, I've included an adorable little puppy pic, because nobody can be scared of a cute little doggy. With that in mind, it is 100 seconds to midnight. And that means what you probably think it means. Midnight is the collapse of human civilization, an extinction-level event. But before we jump straight into the void, we're going to go down two rabbit trails. Here's the first. That 100 seconds clock that you see up there comes from the Bulletin of the Atomic Scientists. And as you might suspect from the word atomic in the name, this organization was started in the 1940s. In fact, right after the bombing of Hiroshima and Nagasaki, the scientists on the Manhattan Project got together to form a nonprofit to warn us about the dangers that they had just unleashed onto the world. And I kind of love that they haven't changed their name in 73 years, right? Because atomic reminds me of Disney's Tomorrowland, sponsored by the Monsanto Chemical Company, right? And look, I'm not just saying that for cheap laughs. Back in the 1940s, 1950s, we had this fundamental optimism about science. Sure, some scientific developments were scary, mushroom cloud level scary, but underneath it all, science meant this great, big, beautiful tomorrow, right? It meant the Jetsons, personal jetpacks, teal spaceships with big tail fins, the idea that we could, you know, kind of technology our way out of any problem. And back when Monsanto was not quite synonymous with total evil. And I'm kind of old. And as a kid of the 1980s, that's the world that I grew up in, right? An optimistic world. And in many ways, I still believe in, and I want to share that vision of optimism with you today, at a time where optimism is in short supply. Because look, I think skeptics really are uniquely positioned to blend that 1950s-style optimism with 21st-century realism. And that's kind of what the Bulletin of the Atomic Scientists tries to do. They inform us about existential risks. And it seems weird to say this in the midst of a global pandemic, but right now, the two major risks to the future of human civilization are climate change and nuclear war. COVID doesn't really register. It's 30% unemployment, radical changes to our way of life. They're bad. There are a lot of negative utils, but they're not existential threats to humanity or to human civilization. Anyway, put a pin in that for now, because we're about to head down that second rabbit trail. Now, we're not live, but I am going to pull up the chat box, and I want you to go ahead and type in your answers. Really, take a look at these six faces and tell me what they have in common. And I want you to really study it. So let me take that blue box off. Have you figured it out yet? That's right. None of these belong to real human beings. In fact, you can open up a browser window right now and go to www.thispersondoesnotexist.com. And every time you refresh it, the site will pop up with a unique face of somebody who absolutely, positively does not exist. Here's the surprising thing. Each and every one of those pictures was created not by a person, not with any intelligent design, but by an artificial intelligence. And that's because, as it turns out, humans are really not good at creating things that look like themselves. Perhaps you've heard of the concept of the uncanny valley. We talk about it a lot these days when we're looking at characters in video games that don't quite look right, or CGI movies. But as it turns out, the uncanny valley was first explored by Masahiro Mori 50 years ago in an article for the Japanese magazine Energy, in which Mori discussed our affection for or revulsion to things like cute little toy robots or less cute Japanese theater puppets or prosthetic hands. His thesis was there was a point where, as we started to make things that looked more and more lifelike, they would actually become less and less appealing to us. That thesis lay dormant for about 4 decades and was rediscovered recently. And I have to say, as a thesis, it's pretty intuitive. Although I should add, we're all skeptics here, that there is indeed robust debate in the psychological literature about the validity of the underlying psychology. That's beyond the scope of this talk. All I'm taking away from Mr. Mori are 2 points. First, we can't make things that look entirely like ourselves. And second, as we get closer and closer to the real thing, it turns out that we're really, really good at realizing that something's missing, even if we don't know exactly how to fill in those tiny details that are left out, the things that separate an artificially generated person from a person. So as a result of those 2 things, just like Emma in the chat, we are really confident that our brains are 100% accurate, that we can distinguish fake from reality, that we can't fool ourselves with an imitation. There's just one problem. Yeah, AI does not care. Because you see, AI doesn't go about creating faces or building lifelike robots the way you or I would, right? You or I would do something like this, right? We'd start by looking at other faces. We'd try to copy them as best as we can. We'd reduce to shapes familiar faces, right? And inevitably, even if we're talented artists, we wind up with something like this, right? The end product guy who looks kind of like, I don't know, like a less smug Rimmer from Red Dwarf after a steroid regimen. Anyway, you'd never mistake that guy for a real human, right? Because we suck at this. AI goes about building faces very, very differently. And in 5 years, it's gone from the sub-Rimmer hominid over there on the left to the one on the right that I think would fool even Emma, that is indistinguishable from reality. The technique, and you can read it at the link below, is a specific kind of machine learning. It's called a generative adversarial network, or GAN, and it was invented by Ian Goodfellow in 2014. And his idea was to take advantage of the things that computers do much better than we do. So it's an evolutionary algorithm.
requires no external input once the original parameters are set up. Here's how it works. You start off with a machine randomly generating a picture of a person using randomly generated techniques. As you might imagine, that first batch looks nothing like a person, right? But when it does better, you want to tell it that, right? So it will try similar techniques for the next face, and vice versa. When the computer generates something that looks nothing like a human face, you want to hit the down button and tell it not to do that again. And then you do it a million times. Then you do it a billion times. Then you do it an uncountable number of times. Now, look, there are two ways to do this. You could sit at the computer clicking good or bad. That would be an outstanding approach if you plan to live to be several thousand years old and have nothing but time on your hands. If you don't have that kind of time, but you do have a second computer lying around, then you could just train a second AI to do that work for you, right? It would look at the first AI's picture and try and guess whether it's a real person or not. That's the adversarial part of generative adversarial network. The two AIs are adversaries, one trying to trick the other into thinking it's a real face, and the second one trying to guess when it's being tricked. As a result, you get an evolutionary arms race, the kind that in nature led to cheetahs running at 90 kilometers per hour and gazelles at 85, right? The faster the gazelle gets, the more the slower cheetahs die off. The faster the cheetah gets, in order to catch the gazelle, that culls all the slower gazelles and so on and so forth. The gazelle gets faster, the cheetah gets faster. It's an evolutionary arms race, the kind that were summarized by Richard Dawkins in The Blind Watchmaker as, quote, more likely to generate highly complex weapons systems. So yeah, put a pin in that. Here's how it works. When our two adversarial AIs start out, they both suck. The first AI knows almost nothing about how to draw people. And the second AI knows almost nothing about how to tell artificial pictures apart from real ones. But over time, they both get better at their jobs. And then they get way better. So look, GAN debuts in 2014, and it's terrible. It's worse than the stuff that we're doing. But within a year, our AI gets to the uncanny valley, that kind of creepy, not quite real picture in 2015. By 2016, it generates that, I don't know, out of focus supermodel in the middle. By 2017, you now have the picture, you know, isn't that the guy from the movie with the thing? By 2018, they're generating faces that are literally indistinguishable from real life. So that's our second rabbit trail. Back to the Bulletin of the Atomic Scientists. Remember how I told you that the two major existential risks that they care about are climate change and nuclear war? We should really be considering that one risk, because the major reason nuclear war is so dangerous is because it has the potential to radically alter our climate. That is the science of nuclear winter. And as with climate change, there has been a dedicated and well-funded effort to discredit the actual science of nuclear winter. Alan Robach is the leading researcher. I encourage you to Google Robach nuclear winter or head to the link that I have up there and read his papers for yourself. Nuclear war isn't like other wars, but bigger. It's different in kind. And as it turns out, we've kind of known that ever since we invented nuclear weapons. So this is the doomsday clock. It's the metaphor all of those atomic scientists came up with for how close we are to an existential threat to humanity. In 1947, that was 7 minutes to midnight. Now, the clock has fluctuated over the years. During tense times, it gets closer to midnight, such as 1953, when both the U.S. and the then Soviet Union tested thermonuclear bombs. But it's also moved backwards when we've made progress, when countries have come together, reduced their nuclear stockpiles, taken action on climate change. The safest we've ever been is 1991. In 1991, we had the fall of the Berlin Wall, the collapse of the Soviet Union. It was 17 minutes to midnight. 17 minutes to midnight wouldn't even show up on that slide. The minute hand would be below the horizontal axis. That's how safe we were. And man, remember 1991? Al Gore had just invented the internet. The cell phone looked like a communicator from Star Trek, and you could admit to liking the music of Def Leppard unironically. Look, by the way, I have to confess, I have no idea if any of these cultural references are landing at all, but I do seriously love Def Leppard. Anyway, here's what's happened to the clock in the 20 years since 1991. Now, that brief move from 5 minutes to six and then back to five, that happened in 2010 when the industrialized nations signed on to the UN Climate Change Conference in 2009 and agreed to cap carbon emissions at 2%, at two degrees Celsius, right? It was a great moment. But once again, it's my country's fault. When the U.S. failed to act on that cap by 2012, they reset the clock back to 5 minutes, and it has been downhill ever since. 6 months ago, they moved it to 100 seconds. That's the closest we've ever been to disaster. Now, in 2020, I probably don't have to tell you why we're close to disaster, but I'm going to anyway, right? As it turns out, the international agreements that we've used to manage the risks of nuclear war are being hollowed out. The U.S., Russia, and China have all opposed the Treaty on the Prohibition of Nuclear Weapons. Those things you probably expected. You probably also expected that over the past 5 years, we've had a rising tide of nationalism, right? You have Brexit. We have Trump. We know it's bad. But then they said something I didn't expect that made it much, much worse. And so I'm going to leave this long quote up here for a while because it really digs into the why of how we're losing our trust in our international institutions. Sure. The simple cause is the growing trend in the world for political leaders to dismiss facts they don't like as fake news. But look at how fake news is manufactured through deep fakes that are essentially undetectable as false. And now you have some idea why a lawyer spent the first part of this talk trying to explain evolutionary AIs drawing human faces. Because look, it's not just faces. Last year, you might remember that certain people created the easiest deepfake in the world. It was just a speech by our Speaker of the House, that is the leader of the opposition party to Donald Trump, Nancy Pelosi. And it took a speech of hers, slowed it down by 25%. And the effect of that was to make it look like she was drunk and slurring her words or maybe mentally impaired. But I want you to check out the bottom line of that Guardian story. That's right. As of last week, Facebook, which has announced a new policy about deepfakes, refuses to take down this video, even though it is 100% fake. And if you're wondering, hey, man, you're the lawyer. Isn't this against the law? The answer is almost certainly not. In the United States, we have robust, nearly absolute freedom of speech, particularly political speech. And you know what? You don't care about that. Right. I originally had 12 slides here about the New York Times v. Sullivan standard, but you don't have New York Times v. Sullivan. What you have is Section 12 of the Human Rights Act of 1998 that protects freedom of expression. And the Human Rights Act, unlike New York Times v. Sullivan, reflects a European approach to speech that's more balanced, that's weighed against other social goods. Right. And that approach doesn't always assume that speech is always valuable. It doesn't assume that the answer to toxic speech is always more speech. And by the way, yes, this is still good law after Brexit. So does the Human Rights Act of 1998 permit the law to restrict political deepfakes? Could ask Emma during the chat because I'm no UK lawyer, but I think the answer is no. Now, British law certainly has a lot more exceptions to freedom of speech, leaves a lot more space for regulation than its American counterpart, right? And those exceptions cover a wide range of categories: harassment, racist hate speech, incitement to terrorism, derogation of religious belief, defamation under a broader standard, identifying crime victim. There are lots of exceptions. But none of them apply, as far as I can tell, to taking the real words that someone has said, but making them look bad. So here's what that means for you as skeptics. It means an increasing world in which you can see headlines, screenshots, even full videos that are essentially undetectable as false. And that means that you're going to need your skeptical toolkit to evaluate stories in the news, particularly legal stories. And I'm not going to lie to you, that's hard, but I'm here to help. And I've got three principles for you to follow. So we all race to be first. I do it on my show, right? And look, I'm really proud that we've covered some big stories before the rest of the news media caught up to them. But one of the things we don't do on Opening Arguments is we don't cover a legal story until I can get the actual documents. And that's because when documents are filtered through the reporting of someone else, the media, interest groups, everybody, they tend to be terrible at summarizing and accurately reflecting what's in those documents. Here's an example. And this time, we're definitely going to make fun of my country because I think we're just ahead of you in terms of insanity. But, you know, don't go getting a swelled head about that. You might remember that one of the very first things that our racist, xenophobic game show host of a president did upon taking office was issue an executive order banning entry into the United States from 7 predominantly Muslim nations. That first executive order was written by, and this is a precise legal term, idiots. And so, in addition to all of the terrible racist stuff it also did things that were both terrible and clearly unconstitutional. One of those was it prevented nationalized American citizens who were vacationing in foreign countries from returning home. It was, as the orange man on the screen says, a total and complete shutdown. Because of that, really good lawyers at the ACLU went out and got an injunction that prevented that first executive order from going into effect. And look, that was unquestionably a good thing. But here's how the lawyers at the ACLU characterized their victory that night. Court declares Muslim ban unconstitutional. That wasn't true. And that gave you, if you were a decent human being, hoping that the courts would shut down Donald Trump, the false hope that Trump couldn't bar Muslims from entering into this country, that the courts had stopped him for good, that they'd ruled it unconstitutional, impermissible. And that wasn't true. By the next morning, Sunday morning, the ACLU had corrected its reporting. What had happened was that a federal court issued a temporary injunction. It didn't rule on the merits. It didn't declare anything unconstitutional. It said because this ban was overly broad and prohibited American citizens from returning home, it was unconstitutional, impermissible under the laws of our nation. But you didn't learn any of that if you just read the first story. Even though the ACLU was a super reputable source, they're the ones who litigated this. And even when they corrected it, they put the little spin that I've highlighted up there that each of these 5 cases was a defeat for President Trump. Not really. It took the Trump administration 2 more drafts, but eventually our Supreme Court did rule on the merits of his travel ban. And they ruled that the Muslim ban was, in fact, constitutional, which is something we had been saying on Opening Arguments all along. Not that we wanted it to be, but that this is what happens when you elect a racist. He puts racist policies into effect, and you can't always rely on the courts to bail you out. I have to share just one more story of how people can use the perils of being first to mislead you because of just how effective it was. And again, it has to deal with our criminal game show host of a president. And I know we're across the pond and all, but you do know that our president has committed lots and lots of crimes, right? Because like half of my country seems to not care. Anyway, here's a quick rundown on what happened. This totally calm person here, who looks like the Keebler elves' racist grandpa, is Jeff Sessions. He was nominated to be a federal district court judge back in the 1980s by Ronald Reagan. Ronald Reagan is sort of our knockoff Margaret Thatcher. Anyway, that nomination failed because, as it turns out, Jeff Sessions is big old racist. And four decades ago, that sort of thing used to be disqualifying. I just realized you probably have no idea who the Keebler elves are. Look, Keebler is kind of the McVitties of the United States. Anyway, I had to leave the references because this resemblance is dead on. It's the Keebler mascot on the left, by the way. So that's an uncanny valley for you. Anyway, when our country very sensibly decided that Jeff Sessions was too racist to be a federal judge, he did not simply crawl back into his tree and make biscuits. Instead, Sessions decided to go home to his state of Alabama and run for the Senate. And he won, and then he won re-election three times. And then in 2016, as you saw in that delightful picture, he was the first United States senator to endorse Donald Trump for president. And when, God help us, Donald Trump won election in 2016, he repaid Jeff Sessions for his loyalty by naming him attorney general. Now, to be clear, our attorney general is the person in charge of our entire Department of Justice, of administering all of the federal laws in our country. So, to recap, the guy who was too racist to be allowed in the building in 1987 was now, I guess, just racist enough to be in charge of the entire department once Trump was elected. For a little while, anyway. We'll get to that. But as it turns out, we owe that racist little elf at least a little debt of gratitude because he had the tiniest smidgen of a conscience. You see, from the earliest stages of the Trump administration, there was credible evidence that during the campaign, our president had accepted assistance from Russia, knew that would benefit his campaign, and when he won, set up a secret back channel with Russia to communicate with them after he was elected president, but before he took office. And again, I know most of you aren't lawyers. Most of you are definitely not U.S. lawyers. So trust me when I tell you that violates all kinds of laws. And the person in charge of figuring out whether and which laws the president violated was Attorney General Jeff Sessions. And Jeff Sessions, bless his tiny little elfin heart, acknowledged that he couldn't do that. He was a part of the Trump campaign, right? You see him wearing that stupid white hat. He was not impartial. And therefore, he did the thing he is required by ethics to do and recused himself. That left the deputy attorney general, a friend of mine named Rod Rosenstein, in charge of this investigation. And he appointed a special counsel, an outside lawyer named Robert Mueller, to investigate these allegations. Sessions' moment of conscience, by the way, was his death knell. He was fired by President Trump for disloyalty. So he thought he'd do the same thing he did last time, right? Go back to his home state of Alabama and run for his old job in the Senate again. Except that when you cross Donald Trump, he doesn't just burn your house to the ground. He salts the earth so that nothing can grow there ever again. So Trump recruited and backed a former college football coach, that's American football, and probable hominid named Tommy Tuberville to run against Sessions. They're both Republicans. They have identical policies. The only issue in the campaign was who was more pro-Trump. Tuberville's most prominent campaign ad accused Sessions of, and this is a direct quote, quote, not being man enough, end quote, to stand with President Trump. Last week, Tuberville beat Sessions by a 2-1 margin to become the Republican Senate nominee for Alabama. He will very likely be elected a senator in the fall, notwithstanding the fact that he has zero political experience and has been credibly accused of defrauding investors out of their money. But back to Robert Mueller. After he was hired, Mueller conducted a thorough 2-year examination and produced a 2-volume, 400-page report. As a result of that investigation, 8 of Donald Trump's closest advisors were indicted and either pled guilty or were tried, convicted by a jury, and sentenced to prison, one of whom is still awaiting sentence. That includes his campaign chairman. It includes his deputy campaign chairman. It includes 3 key advisors and his personal attorney. Oh, and by the way, the Mueller report also very clearly detailed 9 specific impeachable crimes committed by Donald Trump himself in trying to cover up the crimes that all of his campaign associates were committing. If any of this is news to you, we summarized this on episode 324 of Opening Arguments. Our president is a criminal. But back to the report. You see, Robert S. Mueller was special counsel. That means he was an outsider. He was hired by the deputy attorney general to prepare that internal investigation. And so under our laws, the first person who gets to see the Mueller report was the guy who hired him and his boss, the attorney general. Remember the racist elf, Jeff Sessions, except that in the 2 years it took for Mueller to prepare his report, Trump had already retaliated, fired Sessions for disloyalty, and replaced him with this guy. That's our current attorney general, Bill Barr, on the left. On the right is an angry baby dinosaur puppet from a TV show that was inexplicably popular here in the States in the 1990s. Again, sorry for the cultural references, but you got to admit that resemblance is dead on. And look, I did hook you guys up with that sweet Red Dwarf reference about 40 slides ago. The evil cartoon puppet on the left got an advance copy of the Mueller report. And it was, again, technical legal terms, super duper bad for his boss. So if you're an evil puppet and you have a 400-page document that lays out all the crimes your boss has committed and you don't want people to know that, what do you do? And the answer is you lie. So the evil puppet prepared a 3-page memorandum that purported to summarize that report before any of us could read it. And he distributed that memo first to the press. It began with, "I summarize the principal conclusions set out in the special counsel's report." In reality, it did no such thing. Barr's memo said that the report concluded no collusion. With a straight face, he said that that 400-page document, the one that led to the indictment, arrest, and conviction of 8 of the president's closest associates and laid out 9 specific crimes the president had committed, completely exonerated the president. That was 100% a lie. But because media sources wanted to be first, here's what they ran with. Yeah, that headline from the Dallas Morning News in 900-point font was retweeted out by the president. It wasn't just Dallas. Every major media outlet went with the same story. No collusion. No conspiracy, inferred the Washington Post and the New York Times, 2 of our best newspapers. Because you see, we needed the news first. And the actual document wasn't available. So literally every single one of these news outlets just took Bill Barr's word for it. And as it turns out, Bill Barr is a liar. His 3-page summary quoted the Mueller report 3 times. Each one of these quotes turned out to be what respectable lawyers call materially misleading and what I call bullshit. Quote number 1. The investigation did not establish that members of the Trump campaign conspired or coordinated with the Russian government in its election interference activities. All right, that certainly looks like it exonerates the president until you compare it with what the report actually says. And by the way, that little bracket around the T is your hint when you're reading the memo that he's quoting from the middle of the sentence, which he was. Barr left out that the part he quoted was preceded by, I swear to God, I am not making this up, an although. So, yeah, when you read the immediately prior sentence, you see that the report determined that the Russians worked to secure a Trump presidency, that the Trump campaign knew about it, welcomed their help, and expected to benefit from it. But what we couldn't quite prove was that they directly coordinated. One of the reasons that Mueller could not quite prove that is because the president instructed his subordinates to lie about that coordination. And the person in charge of that coordination was Roger Stone. He lied. He was arrested, tried, convicted, sentenced to 3.5 years in prison, and then pardoned by the president, who told him to lie. So, yeah, that although kind of changes the meaning of Barr's quote a little bit, doesn't it? And by the way, the other 2 quotes were similarly butchered. Now, in partial fairness to the New York Times, the Washington Post, and others, they couldn't have known that because they didn't have the Mueller report. On the other hand, let's not be too fair, right? It's obvious that all of these quotes were taken from the middle of a sentence. They could have been a little bit skeptical. They could have said, Attorney General Barr says, but they didn't. They said, no collusion, no conspiracy. And that's why, according to an Ipsos poll taken in June of 2019. 2 months after the Mueller report came out, was fully vetted by everyone, after it was obvious that the president committed all the crimes, only 3% of Republicans said it made them more likely to support impeachment. That led one congressman, and only one, Justin Amash of Michigan, to resign from the Republican Party because he actually read the Mueller report. Everybody else relied on summaries. And that's why 54% of Republicans said the Mueller report made no difference. The remaining 42% said the Mueller report made them less likely to support impeachment of the president. Why? Because they believed no collusion. Bill Barr went first, and he was able to say that a document meant the opposite of what that document said. And that's as terrifying as any deep fake I can imagine. So what can we do? We can demand to see the underlying documents. We can wait until reputable sources have analyzed those documents. And we can know that even reputable sources sometimes get it wrong. Okay. Second tool in your toolkit is what I call understand first and argue second. It means you do not want to pick your argument and then go looking for the evidence to support it. You want to do the opposite. Those of you who listen to my show might remember that 3 years ago, I had a debate with a guy named Travis Wester. And Travis had a fundamental belief that American colleges and universities were hostile to conservative political voices. And because of that belief, he really, really wanted to believe that a nuisance lawsuit filed by right-wing provocateur Ann Coulter against the University of California at Berkeley was going to be this watershed moment for conservatives. It was going to expose all the flaws in the liberal academic system, and it was going to end discrimination against right-wing speakers on college campuses. There was only one problem with Travis's argument. That stuff isn't real, and Ann Coulter's lawsuit was nonsense. But in 2017, Travis came on my show to argue that it wasn't. It didn't go well for Travis. And to understand why, I need to teach you a little bit about how U.S. cases work. This is Plessy versus Ferguson. Now, again, I know it's my country's legal system. It is one of the most wrong and reviled cases in United States history. That's the one that upheld segregation after the Civil War in 1896. It said, yeah, separate but equal is fine. It was overruled in 1954 by what I think, what I hope is, the most famous and celebrated legal case in U.S. history, a case called Brown versus Board of Education. That was the one that said separate is inherently unequal, that we were wrong in Plessy versus Ferguson, that forced the integration of public schools. So Plessy hasn't been good law for almost seven decades, right? Keep that in mind. The caption on the left is what you see if you type Plessy versus Ferguson into Google Scholar. You go do that right now. The caption on the right is what I see when I type Plessy versus Ferguson into Lexis, right, which is a commercial for-pay legal service that, by and large, lawyers and law students are the only ones that have. Who can spot the difference between these two captions? Right. Mine has a bright red stop sign on it. And that stop sign means, Andrew, if you try and cite this case in a brief, opposing counsel, the judge, and her clerks are all going to laugh at you because this case has been overruled. But the one you pull up doesn't have a little red stop sign on it. It doesn't have anything to tell you that this case isn't good law. Now, look, most people in the United States know that Plessy versus Ferguson isn't good law. But what about when it's Smith versus Alabama? That is what Travis Wester did in our debate. He kept citing a case from the Fifth Circuit that had one of those big red stop signs on it. But he didn't know that because his copy didn't have the stop sign. And also, he didn't know that the Fifth Circuit covers Texas, Louisiana, and Mississippi. Those are the dark orange states at the bottom of the map, and not California, which is the big purple state all the way over there on the left. It's kind of like citing the Court of Appeal of New South Wales as dispositive over a case arising in London, right? And also, he cited to a dissent, right? Yeah, you guys have dissents over here, right? You know that the dissent is the side that lost? So what I realized was, the way Travis was arguing about the law was the way a lot of people argue online, right? What they do is they form their argument, then they sit down at Google and they type the phrase that they're interested in and see if there's an authority that supports what they want, right? That says what they want it to say. And then they argue from that authority, even if they're not sure that the authority is the right court or the right part of the opinion or even still good law at all. If this were science, you would immediately see the problem, right? You don't pick your conclusion and then cherry pick the data backwards to try and support it. The law is the same way, right? You should understand the principles first and then develop your argument. Because as with science, if you look hard enough, you can always find one weird data point to support you, particularly if you don't know, don't care which ones have the stop signs. Very briefly, I do not need to tell you that the Ann Coulter lawsuit was total nonsense. Here is the local Fox affiliate in 2018 describing the inevitable settlement, which is what I predicted on my show, as the university agreeing to, quote, consider non-substantive changes and that the settlement was, quote, indistinguishable from total victory. So look, the lesson isn't don't argue. I love arguing, right? The lesson is understand the facts first and pick your argument second, not the other way around. Look, Travis could have constructed a non-crazy argument that conservative voices are underrepresented on college campuses in the United States. That's not ridiculous. It's not undebatable. I don't agree with it, but you could have engaged. But when you cite the dissent from an overruled case from a circuit that doesn't apply, people tend to think that nothing in your argument has any merit. And that leads us to the third tool in the toolkit. Be wary of efforts to play to your emotions and your preconceived notions. And since we're 45 minutes into this talk, I got to tell you, you're going to have to trust me on this one or look up some of my prior talks in which I tell you what these two turkeys have in common. Trust me, it's a good story. I mean, it's a good story until you realize that the punchline is that thanks to our ridiculous first-past-the-post voting system, our most left-wing voters in my country in 2016 not only handed the presidency to a racist game show host, but also lined the grifter on the left pockets with $6 million when they realized what a mistake they'd made. They were feeling guilty about the first part, and so the second part happened. So those are your three tools. Be patient. Look for the source documents. Understand first. Argue second. And watch out for efforts to appeal to your emotions. 3 years ago, Vladimir Putin said, artificial intelligence is the future, not only for Russia, but for all humankind. Whoever becomes the leader in this sphere will become the leader of the world. And a lot of people thought Putin was talking about killbots, Terminators, sci-fi stuff. And look, I really don't want to give Vladimir Putin killbots. But I think Putin was talking about applying AI in an area where Russia is already an expert. Cyber warfare, fake news, where AI is already generating highly complex weapons systems. Sorry, wrong slide. Earlier this week, your government reluctantly put out a report on their investigations into the Russian interference with the Brexit referendum. Here's how the Intelligence and Security Committee of Parliament described Russia's foreign policy ambitions. Fundamentally nihilistic, Russia seems to see foreign policy as a zero-sum game. Any actions that damage the West are fundamentally good for Russia. It continues, and here I'm going to paraphrase, that Russia views anything that undermines democratic and international political and economic institutions as, by negative implication, reinforcing the Russian worldview that might is right. And so I see the future of Russian AI as not wiping us out with autonomous killbots, but by convincing enough of us who believe in democracy to wipe ourselves out with fake news that is essentially undetectable as false. Unless we get much, much better at this very, very quickly. Those are our stakes. We've already been manipulated into electing an irresponsible, incompetent, xenophobic racist. We already have major political parties in both our countries whose guiding principles are withdrawing from international agreements. We're already starting to lose confidence in the democratic process. I truly believe that our lives literally hang in the balance. Otherwise, I would have come here and made fun of sovereign citizens for an hour. It would have been a lot more fun. Hopefully, I've entertained you today with some decent jokes, some bewildering cultural references, and occasionally funny slides. But I want to leave you here with this one. This was the losing screen from a 1986 video game called Balance of Power. Now, it was available on the Spectrum, so some of you may have played it. It was the first international relations simulator, and I played the hell out of it as a kid. In that game, you lost when you triggered nuclear war. And back then, right, the actual gameplay was 8-bit. So one of the things that video games did was they put these snazzy 320 by 192 graphic cut screens and splash pages. Chris didn't do that because he wanted to send a message. This is that message. We do not reward failure. I want to send that message too. It is 100 seconds to midnight. It is time to act. So thank you.
So, welcome back, everyone. Hope you've all topped up your glasses and are ready for what I'm sure is going to be a fascinating Q&A after such a fascinating talk. And thanks once again to Andrew for such a brilliant and terrifying experience. So, got a lot of questions now. Let's take bets on how many we'll get through. Let's see. So, for no reason at all, I'm going to start with a question here from Teresa Gomez, who asks, calling out bad headlines from good sources is good, but it is also used by others to discredit those sources. How do we call out our own side effectively?
Yeah. Wow. Somehow, even across the pond, Teresa Gomez gets to be first. I have an entire point in my lecture about not having to be first all the time. So come on, Teresa. But seriously, I think it's an excellent question, and it's part of what we try and do in opening arguments. And I think like the answer is really contained in the predicate of the question, right? Which is we need to I call this like the shirts and skins mentality sometimes, but like we have, it's perfectly reasonable to do a first cut of media sources, right? And say things like, oh, look, InfoWars is not a reliable source. And similarly, like the Krasensteins on Twitter, even, you know, however much you might like their like far lefty memes, right? Like you can figure out the lefty sources that are similarly unreliable. So first cut is remove those sources from your life, even if you agree with them and you like their memes. And even if they're saying the kinds of things that you support politically, if they're supporting them for bad reasons, like you're going to wind up more likely to parrot a bad source. And then when you're left with like previously vetted sources, always remember to be as skeptical of the vetted sources as you would be if you'd left InfoWars in your, in your feed. And beyond that, I'm not sure that there's a specific mechanism, right? I think you build up credibility, right? It's something we've tried to do on the show to say like, hey, look, like we don't want to tell you what you want to hear. We want to tell you what the law is. And I think, you know, the story from the talk about not overplaying our hand on the first Muslim ban, right, is a really, really good illustration of that, right? Like, I did not want to tell people the president of the United States probably has the power to restrict immigration for racist reasons. The problem is, under the law, the president of the United States has the power to restrict immigration for racist reasons. And so saying you don't have to be worried about this, right, is a depressant against activism, right? It says, don't worry, we got it covered. ACLU is going to knock this out of the park. And they didn't. And so, you know, I think it's really important to know the status of where things really are. So I'm not sure how much that answered Teresa's question, but that's my approach.
Sounds sensible to me. This question is from Anonymous, possible controversial question, they think. Is federal forces being sent into Portland against the wishes of the local / state government in breach of the Constitution?
Okay, great question. And an opportunity to plug tomorrow's episode of Opening Arguments, which is about 90 minutes long. We cut all of our other segments and the Thomas Takes the Bar exam to really try and dig into everything that's going on in Portland and the underlying law. I'm not going to give you a 90-minute answer right here, which has Emma laughing, which is good. But the answer is there is a great deal of what is going on in Portland that is illegal, unconstitutional, and will be remedied. But this hits, right, as a lawyer, like you're familiar with this concept of in the concept of sort of, you know, the judgment proof plaintiff, right? Like the idea that you can hit a point where you get relief, but the relief sometimes is far too late to do any good. I break down exactly what that is on the show tomorrow. And it underscores, this is really the serious part. People in Portland right now are heroes in the true sense of the word, right? They are engaged in nonviolent participation demonstration that is putting them at severe risk of life and limb. There are journalists who have been shot in the face with rubber bullets, one who has gone blind, others who have been hospitalized, right? What you have right now are militarized forces who are not trained to deal with crowd dispersal using SWAT tactics to disperse peaceful crowds. And anybody who's there who's putting their life on the line, I really think we need to salute on that. So answer the question, lots of illegality. Listen to the show tomorrow. And if you know somebody who's participating in the protests, thank them.
All right. There's probably a few follow-ups to that, but I will just encourage everyone to listen to the show tomorrow for the full details of that. So another anonymous question. In relation to the doomsday clock, is there a published methodology for the time on the clock?
No, the clock is not scientific. The clock, as I said in my speech, is a metaphor. And, you know, how do you parse 100 seconds to 90 seconds to what, you know, it's a metaphor. So no, there is no methodology. I think somebody in the main chat included the link to the January 23rd report. If not, you can very easily Google it. And I would encourage you to read that whole report and you'll see that I was, if anything, downplaying it during the talk. It's it changed my life. Like, right. Like I changed my talk that I usually give as a result of reading it. So,
OK, so this is a question from Sean Ellis. Why didn't the newspapers check Barr's summary by, say, phoning Mueller and asking, is this true?
Great question. And there's sort of two answers to that. The first is Mueller. There are a couple of things you need to remember about Robert Mueller, right? The first is he is an institutionalist, somebody who has a very strong respect for protocol. And he declined, the media did call, and he declined to answer those questions. The second thing you need to know is that Robert Mueller is of the same political party as Rod Rosenstein and Jeff Sessions and Donald Trump. He is a very conservative Republican. He was not an adversary. He was not a liberal activist trying to bring down the administration. He was a lawyer who was hired to do his job, and he did his job. He would not have commented on his job while it was in the vetting process. But something that has gone unnoticed that this gives me a great opportunity to amplify is that while Bill Barr released his letter, Robert Mueller wrote three separate super angry letters to Bill Barr saying, hey, man, you're lying about what's in my report. And Bill Barr, you know, basically replied with, well, agree to disagree. We do have the evidence from the person who wrote it that Bill Barr's summary was a complete lie. But, you know, there's a law review article I've referenced on the show. I've got a deep dive. I've actually got most of it written, but I just never have the time to air it. And that law review article is called Constitutional Hardball. And it is about the difference in actors between those who play by the rules and play by the spirit of the rules, which was almost everybody until about 2014. And those who disregard the rules and care about the consequences, which has been the Republican Party since 2014. So this is a really strong application of that, right? Like, it is somebody playing by the rules and playing by the spirit of those rules, which is, like, my boss gets to look at my work before I'm done. And that's why he didn't go public, because he was not on our team, so to speak.
Okay. So, next question is, do you think the US or the UK have a better approach to free speech? Because you talked about the differences in your talk.
Yeah. And here, I would really, really like to bring your voice into this, Emma, because you have a direct experience with the British, with the European model of free speech. Very briefly, right? Like, the argument for the U.S. model has not changed in several centuries. It is the John Locke, John Stuart Mill notion that the solution to bad speech is more speech, that even speech that is erroneous produces almost as great a benefit as informing of the truth, which is the reaction by individuals viewing the truth in collision with error. That's a rough paraphrase from On Liberty. And I grew up with that. That is part of the founding sort of mythos of the United States. And I believe that until I was an adult. I believe that for a very, very long time. And it still holds a lot, right? Like, there's still a lot that I think is really persuasive about that model. There are two things that I think lead me to challenge that marketplace of ideas model of free speech, right? And the first I encountered in law school, it's a law review article by Mari Matsuda. It's called Words That Wound. And it is the notion that hate speech is different in kind than political speech, right? It is a speech that is psychologically designed and is effective at silencing minority groups rather than producing a response. And that is a seminal article that has produced, you know, sort of the modern debate over hate speech. And the second principle really is the past 5 years of watching people guided by computer algorithms that is designed to move you to more and more extreme positions, to live in a bubble in which you never see that counter speech. And so those two things have kind of led me to rethink the American model. I don't know that I have a conclusion on better approach, but that's why I'd like to hear from you.
Yes. So if anyone doesn't know, I am. I'm a lawyer. I'm a UK lawyer solicitor and do prison law and human rights work. So I do have some. I know what I'm talking about a little bit. I would say that I think I probably prefer the UK or the more European model, just because. So the European Convention on Human Rights came about out of the sort of the ashes of the Second World War, and the idea of, you know, we have to work together about things and that fundamental human rights are important. And that's where it came from. And it is much more of a compromise than the US model, in that all but one of the articles is what's called derogable, or has exceptions, is the non-legal term to it, which is a fun little quiz. Which one of those doesn't have any exceptions to it? Does anyone want to guess? Andrew, do you want to guess?
That has no exceptions?
Yeah.
Wow. Maybe the right to exit, the right to travel?
No, so the only one that has there's no exceptions to is Article 3, which is prohibition on torture, inhumane and degrading treatment. All other ones have exceptions to them, including the right to life. There are instances, obviously, when that can be deviated from. But that's not to say that we don't also sometimes make mistakes. And so I know you've talked before about the Ashes-Baker case, which is not, wasn't strictly speaking, free speech case, because there was lots of other bits involved in that, but we do sometimes make errors as well. But also the role of our Supreme Court is very different to the role of yours, because you have this one piece of legislation, but the Constitution, that is essentially inviolable, whereas all of our legislation can be changed at any time.
That was, and when we had you on the show again, episode 321, that I think was the biggest, I think you heard it in my voice, of where I learned a lot from you on that episode, but that was a worldview changer, and I'm still kind of processing it. So yeah.
I mean, they are moving towards it a little bit, like with the prorogation cases that we talked about
right.
on the show. They are becoming more of a constitutional court, but it's hard to define that in the UK because there isn't a constitution. Well, there is a constitution. It's just not in one document, and all parts of it could be changed at any point. Mm-hmm. So, yeah. So. Next question, let me see. So this question is from Dave the Drummer. Why the hell can't we prosecute Trump and other buffoons in the UK in power for their egregious violations of law? They seem to be untouchable.
Oh, great question. Again, we'll bring Emma in for the UK portion. In the United States, there were sort of two conceptions, right? The first is that our founding fathers were, among other things, unbelievably naive about the role of politics, right? And so when they set up these checks and balances, they really thought that it's kind of like replicating the earliest beginnings of free market thought, replicating those errors in government. And so here's the big mistake that they made. They set up a system of checks and balances. And what they thought was, if the president is exceeding his power, then members of Congress who want to increase their own power would necessarily stand up and fight against that, right? So you create this kind of tension among all the branches. And they didn't think about, like, well, what if the members of Congress who'd like to be president someday are of the same political party as the president, and therefore there's an organized mechanism whereby when they transfer power, they think like that's going to work out fantastic for them. They didn't consider that. And so when you go back and read the Federalist Papers, it is shockingly naive as to what they thought presidents would be impeached over and how that would be a check against not just illegal, but inappropriate and poor behavior by the president. Now, in fairness to everybody else, I was shockingly naive, right? Like, I thought that when you had a 400-page, two-volume report that says, here are the 9 crimes that the president of the United States has committed, that members of the president's party would say, okay, like, it's time for him to go now. That was the rules. Those were the rules prior to Trump being in office. That was the Nixon standard. And we blew through that because of the way in which Trump governs and took advantage of the system. So that's why impeachment was thought of as sort of a catch-all. And it is broader than just prosecuting somebody for crimes, right? Like, you don't have the presumption of guilty until proven innocent beyond a reasonable doubt, right? You just have whatever standard the Senate sitting as a trial wants to impose. And the president can be impeached for high crimes and misdemeanors, right? Which means that he can be removed for conduct that isn't a criminal offense, right? So that's what they thought would be the major check. In terms of whether we can prosecute Trump, we can prosecute Trump in this country. There are two mechanisms to do so. Number one, he can be indicted once he's out of office. Or number two, he can be named as an unindicted co-conspirator in a grand jury criminal indictment right now. And that indictment can then be sealed and the statute of limitations told until he gets out of office. Now we do it, and I will defend the idea that you shouldn't be able to arrest a sitting president and remove him from the White House. Much as I would like to be able to do that with this one, I think it's clear that the remedy there is impeachment, right? The other remedy is voting him out and bringing charges once he's gone, which I sincerely hope we will do. So why can't we prosecute these buffoons in the UK?
That's an excellent question. I'm not sure that I know that, actually. It's a gaping hole in my knowledge.
Well, this is paying you back for that brevity joke. So.
And so the only thing I know about the Federalist Papers comes from the musical Hamilton.
I have not seen Hamilton. Oh, it's Thomas, amazing. My co-host, hates Hamilton. It's so funny. we'll have to do that another time.
Yes. Okay. So next question is from Anonymous, except I think it was actually me. I think I recognize this question. So have you followed the Russia report debacle? And you mentioned it in your talk. Do you see any similarities with the Mueller report in terms of media spin and trying to be first? The reason I say that is that there was some reporting before it was published where they put the focus on interference in the Scottish independence referendum and kind of it buried the lead of the report, which was, we don't know whether there was interference because we've not looked for it.
So the answer to that is half and half. I have read the Intelligence and Security Committee Russia report that came out a couple days ago. Marsh sent it to me. And I quoted from paragraph 4 in the talk, which summarized, I think, in a really, really good way, the terrifying foreign policy aims of Russia. But I haven't followed, and I'm not kind of part of the, atmospherics in the background to know how this has been spun in the British press. Right. So I don't know how it was received. To me, as you've said, the key takeaways, right? If you are not like me and sort of love reading 50 plus page documents for fun in your spare time, you can read 4 paragraphs. Start at paragraph 42. It's paragraphs 42, 43, 47, and 48. And basically, what that says, right? Your intelligence community has concluded that nobody in the UK set up the ability to gather data to determine whether a hostile foreign power that has been testing out troll farms and cyber warfare successfully managed to elect with my country's help, and I'm sorry for that, but at least one of those guys is now in prison, a pro-Putin stooge in Ukraine as condition precedent to Russia's invasion of Ukraine, right? Like, it's been well established for a decade that this is how Russia does business. They set up troll farms and engage in cyber attacks for their enemies for the purposes of creating confusion. And the report says that it was only when you watched, when your country observed the coordination of WikiLeaks releasing Hillary Clinton's emails that all of a sudden you were like, oh, we should gather some data on this. And that was a month after Brexit. So the answer is we don't know how many of those Brexit votes are Putin bots, are influenced by Russian propaganda, right? And we could talk at length. I'm going on at too long here already, but we could talk at length about like how hacking does not have to mean, you know, breaking into the system and changing the votes, right? Like my understanding is that your elections have far more paper trails than ours, right?
Yeah.
So it's not about that, right? It's about peddling targeted misinformation to a group of voters from a hostile foreign power that does not have a right to participate in that discussion. So, yeah.
Okay. So, sorry, I've just lost myself there. Oh. Here we are. So, very, very serious question next. What is the best Transformers movie and why is it the 1986 animated film?
The reasons the 1986 animated film are genius. One, it is basically a shot-for-shot remake of Star Wars with giant robots. Two, the soundtrack is amazing. And three, as a child, I cried my eyes out when Optimus Prime died. So there you go.
I'm sorry to say I haven't seen it. I apologize. Oh.
We should get drunk and watch it together sometime. It'll be fun.
You're on. Okay, so... next question. Do you know of any opening arguments like podcasts or shows focused on UK law?
Ooh, you know, ask Teresa in the chat because she maintains the OA Wiki, but we had
we had guests on from an OA-like legal podcast focused on UK law in the first season of OA, and I just don't remember the name. I think that podcast is defunct. I think they have not been producing new episodes. Do you remember who I'm talking about?
I think I do know who you're talking about, but I cannot remember the name because it's defunct.
Yeah.
I think that they also were a little bit more practitioner focused, in that it was, I think the aim was the audience. Oh yeah, no, at North Pod Law, someone said it in the chat.
Yes.
It was very much focused on an audience of lawyers rather than general education tool. So it was still interesting, but it was perhaps in some places a little dense for the general population. My answer to are there any is that me and Marsh haven't started it yet. I do have some legal, I have some recommendations. There's one called Better Human, which is a podcast focused on human rights law in the UK by a barrister, Adam Wagner, QC. That's pretty good. And if you want to sort of see law in action, there's one by the BBC that's following the Grenfell Tower inquiry. When it's hearing evidence, it does daily podcasts that summarise the evidence, and they play some of the evidence, and that's very interesting because you hear the cross-examination of witnesses and things almost contemporaneously, which is very interesting to see that working.
That sounds very cool.
So that'd be my recommendations. So in the talk, you showed us the headline with the way that Barr had won the rhetoric in terms of the Mueller report, and people agreed with him because he was first. So is there any is it not the case that there is some benefit to being first because you can win the rhetoric argument?
Sure. And look, if you are, I mean, that sort of goes back to the constitutional hardball question that I talked about, right? Like, if you are completely Machiavellian, right, going first is a great way to manipulate people. I do that. And let me be fair with this, right? Like, there is, right, you know, there's the sort of well-known quote that I think, well, I'm fairly certain derives from your country. It's the, you know, I'm not going to wear boxing gloves and fight by the, you know, Marquis de Queensberry rules when, you know, the other person's in a street brawl, right? And so, so I do think that there is a level of like blending, at least recognition of when others are using, hardball tactics and not, you know, walking into their sucker punch, right? I think, you know, to use a phrase from my country, right? Like the politics ain't beanbag, and that there's an argument to be made for fighting dirty, where the ends can justify the means. But it's hard for me to get behind the idea. I mean, I truly believe that like the different, I don't want to be like nostalgic for the 80s when I grew up from a political standpoint, right? Because like I said, I grew up under Ronald Reagan, who was our knockoff Margaret Thatcher, who completely transformed, American politics by mainstreaming crazy conservative ideas, right? Like, so that was not a fantastic time for American politics, but it was a time at which, while we had competing ideologies and loyalties, we at least were working from a common nucleus of operative facts, right? Like, you could say, you know, hey, I want to, you know, increase the unemployment rate. I want to increase, you know, the minimum wage, right? And you would divide into camps. And if the other side said, well, that's going to cause inflation, you would say, all right, well, let's take a look at the economic data, right? Like, you didn't have somebody saying like, oh yeah, well, that's what a lizard person would say, right? Like so, you know, my goal is to get us back to that like moment where, you know, the other side isn't accusing us of being lizard people or in collusion with the Illuminati or, you know, whatever. And, maybe that's a modest proposal, but that's mine.
Okay. So I'm going to mishmash a couple of questions together here. One of them from Marsh, some from Anonymous. Given the cynicism and mistrust the general public have towards the media, will fake news be its own undoing as effectively people learn to trust nothing? So, for example, how do we prove that this isn't fake, what we're doing right now?
Yeah. Well, So a couple of answers to that, right? So the first is that I think there is some harm in democratizing appeals to authority, right? Like, and this overlaps with my discussion on sovereign citizens, right? Like the way in which sovereign citizens propagate themselves is they cobble together like cargo cult, like tiny little bits from real legal documents. And then they weave this narrative that anybody who is a lawyer would look at and say, you're a crazy person. But it can be superficially appealing if you're just like, oh, well, you know, look, they cited 365, you know, GCL 111, like they must know what they're talking about, right? So there is a risk in democratizing appeals to actual authority. That's fair. But that's the only way you can use when you're dealing with a source that you don't know, right? Like you've got to take kind of that skeptical toolkit to it and say, all right, you know, does this appear to have the hallmarks that you would associate with somebody who is being reliable here, right? Is it, and I would have loved to have gotten into this distinction, right? Is it appropriately footnoted without being over footnoted, right? Like, because one of the things that conspiracy theorists will do is like they'll give you 13 sites for, you know, one proposition and it's designed to like, you know, bury you in a blizzard of bullshit. So that's really, really tough. So yes, real risks. And no, I don't have a solution to that. The second half of Marsh's question about will people learn to trust nothing? I don't think that's the case, right? And it maybe I should have highlighted this more in the talk, but like when you look at the AI algorithms that YouTube uses to feed you more and more extreme content, right? They are generating a kind of trust. It's just that trust comes from a position of emotional agreement and stepwise building, right? So 30 seconds on this, and I might be botching it because again, I'm a lawyer, not an AI person. The way the YouTube algorithm works is YouTube makes more money the longer you stay on YouTube. So a couple of years ago, they developed an algorithm that was designed to feed you not things that are most like the thing that you're currently watching, but if you're currently watching X, what's the thing that we think we can feed you that will make you stay on YouTube longer? And extremist content, as it turns out, shows up really, really well on those algorithms, right? Because people get angry, either angry in agreement or angry in disagreement, but they can't help it. And so, I don't think that it will be a self-correcting process. I think that unless we do something, we are headed towards like mutually incommensurate communities where people are drawing their facts from sources that may not overlap with reality at all, right?
Sure. And now I'm going to go completely rogue and see something that someone's reposted in the chat rather than in the Slido and ask, who is the turkey lady? Who I think, can I answer that? It's Jill Stein,
yes.
Isn't it?
Yes, it is Jill Stein. And I have talked about her in depth in a number of other talks. I didn't ever intend to talk about her in this talk. That was a little bit of gamesmanship with the we're running late. But no, it's her fault that Donald Trump is president. I say this at all of my talks, and I get angry, very, very left people who come up to me to yell at me. Here's 30 seconds on Jill Stein. So she was the nominee of the Green Party, which is ostensibly the party that was going to be more liberal, more to the left of our Democratic Party, which is our left-wing party. She ran a nonsense campaign in which she raised $3 million in 2 years. That is nothing in our politics. When Hillary Clinton lost, and this is really, really crucial, our insane electoral college system meant that Hillary Clinton's loss was due to losing three separate states, Pennsylvania, Wisconsin, and Michigan. And the facts are, I could repost this slide, the numbers, or you can go to Wikipedia yourself and look at the 2016 presidential election. The margin by which Hillary Clinton lost to Donald Trump in those three states was less than the number of votes that Jill Stein got in those three states, right? So in other words, and again, when I say it's her fault, that's a joke. It's not her fault. The fault is that fucking race. Oops, sorry, can I swear? I'll stop. The fault is that racists voted for Donald Trump, right? But it certainly didn't help that in swing states, our most liberal voters voted for somebody with no chance of winning under our first past the post system. So that was the case, right? So that's real bad, but I wouldn't be making fun of Jill Stein, but for what she did next, which was when the results came in, she started a fundraiser for the Green Party that said, hey, I'm filing lawsuits and I'm going to get these elections overturned in Pennsylvania, Wisconsin, and Michigan, and that's going to make Hillary Clinton president. And those were 100%, and I say I've tweeted this at Jill Stein. She is welcome to sue me for defamation. She won't, because she knows this is true. Those are 100% fraudulent claims. She took $6 million in donation in 2.5 weeks and pocketed it for the Green Party. Even today, we do not know where $2 million of that went. That is, you might recall, twice what she raised in 2 years as a presidential candidate, and she raised it on the backs of scared liberals who said, holy, I can't believe I didn't vote for Hillary Clinton. How can I fix this? And Jill Stein was like, well, you can fix it by giving me money. And no, you couldn't, because she's a grifter and a con artist. So there you go.
Yes, I've enjoyed listening to you rant at length about that on opening arguments.
Enjoyed.
Enjoyed.
All right, so, I appreciate the scare quotes.
So next question, another anonymous question. Have the recent surprisingly positive Supreme Court rulings given you any hope that the judicial branch isn't doomed for decades? And as I say that, I cross myself and pray for the life of Ruth Bader Ginsburg.
That's a good thing to do. No, they've made it much, much worse. So I've talked about this on the show. That there really is it's a dual-edged sword, but one edge is much, much sharper than the other. And here's how I explain it, right? And I have been, by the way, not trying to pat myself on the back here, but I have been pushing this theory for 2 years since before Brett Kavanaugh was nominated to the Supreme Court about Chief Justice John Roberts, and it is this. Look, large elements of this are not original to me, but I think I've kind of cobbled them together into a working thesis that is at opposition with most major mainstream media coverage of our Supreme Court. A few people are with me, and I'm trying to get them on the show because we're out there in the wilderness. It is this. John Roberts is a deeply conservative individual. He is also a conservative activist. He wants to use the Supreme Court to reach more conservative opinions and is not bound by precedent, tradition, argument. He would like to use the Supreme Court to do conservative political stuff. He is not your friend. If you disagree with that, read his dissent in Obergefell versus Hodges, which is our gay marriage decision, and then come back and talk to me. But unlike the other four, we have a 9-justice Supreme Court. We have a 5-justice conservative majority, of which John Roberts is the Chief Justice, and I've just described him. The other four I call the howler monkey contingent, right? They are conservative activists who just don't care. They're just flinging poop in their cages and hoping that it lands on, you know, conservative walls. John Roberts does, and this is called the institutional thesis, right? John Roberts cares about, maybe because he's Chief Justice, the fact that his grandkids someday are going to have to read about how he was Chief Justice of the Supreme Court. And we're on a pace for the history books to describe the Roberts Court as the most deplorable Supreme Court in human history, in U.S. history, anyway. And John Roberts does not want that. John Roberts wants to restore faith and confidence in the Supreme Court as a neutral body, even as he's using it as a non-neutral body. And so so my thesis is that the goal in litigation is before the Supreme Court is to shame John Roberts. In other words, if you give him, in a case that has a liberal conservative potential outcome, he will choose the conservative outcome unless you can convince him that choosing that conservative outcome is so bad it will damage the longstanding institutional legacy of the Supreme Court. And that is where we have scored victories. And as proof of that, the first case I will turn you to is the Ross case, the Wilbur Ross case, the Department of Commerce. Go read that. And let me tell you, it will be very, very hard for you to read because it's a Frankenstein opinion. It is sewed together from bits and pieces of different opinions that were written over different times. And the reason for that is I can't prove this part. This is the speculation. Everything I've said so far, I can prove, right? I believe very firmly that that case, and that was about can the Commerce Department add a citizenship question on the census? And the answer to that under a constitution is very clearly no, they can't, right? John Roberts joined the liberals to say that no, they couldn't. But it is clear to me from reading his opinion that he originally was planning to vote the other way. We almost got yes, they could. And you can tell when you start to read the opinion and piece everything together. But what happened in that case, it was actually noticed, filed as a supplemental letter, was that a truly evil Republican operative named Thomas Hofeller, the architect of the strategy to add the citizenship question, died. And when he died, his daughter discovered a secret hard drive among his artifacts. And that secret external hard drive contained a folder that was called, and I am not making this up, how to advantage Republican white people. Okay. I'm not getting the exact, but like literally it was like white Republicans. And in that folder of how to advantage white Republicans was add a citizenship question to the census. Right. And then there was all this, well, like obviously that would be illegal. And yeah, you know, like it's the definition, right. Emma's shaking her head of a smoking gun. Right. It is. You don't. It doesn't smoke any better than that. And that was sent to the Supreme Court. And I think that was so embarrassing that it got John Roberts to switch his vote and say, all right, like we're I'm not going to be the like let us advantage Republican white people guy. Right. The recent Supreme Court rulings, we covered them all in opening arguments, but I'm just going to pause briefly on the June Medical Services case. Right. The abortion case. That's a case in which literally the exact same law was affirmed by the Supreme Court 4 years ago. And I think Whole Women's Health versus Hellerstedt was 2016. Might be off on the years. But they came up and they lost. And then the justice who wrote that opinion, Justice Kennedy, the swing vote, died. And so activists were like, oh, look, well, Kennedy's gone. So let's try again. And they passed literally the exact same law. And John Roberts's opinion boils down to like, come on, guys, you can't give me the exact same law. Give me something a little bit different and I'll gut the hell out of women's reproductive rights. But I can't do the same thing we just turned down a couple of years ago. Come on. So I think John Roberts is an evil genius who needs to be shamed. And I am terrified by the fact that media are willing to jump on the bandwagon of look at how bipartisan and liberal he, when he isn't, he is an evil genius. So, thanks for that, for letting me rant about that.
No worries. Hashtag shame John Roberts.
Shame so, John Roberts.
So, question from Freeman off the wagon. Will you do a UK tour post COVID?
I would absolutely love to do that. I used to get to London. I used to represent Lloyd's of London. And so I used to travel to London at least once and sometimes multiple times a year, although I didn't have a lot of time, a lot of free time to explore. So so I love the city. I have never been to the countryside. Would love to go. So, yeah, if there are groups that can make that happen and we can fly in an enclosed tube without people being disease vectors, I'm all for it.
If QED can ever happen again.
I have wanted, everybody says, you know, and I've talked to Marsh and Andy and everybody tells me that that QED is the place to go. So I have long wanted to go and hopefully I can sometime.
Okay. Speaking of Andy Wilson, question from Andy Wilson. Could you do a quick explanation of the circuit system, please? Why do things go to different circuits? Is it just geography?
So, yes, it is just geography. We're not going to pull up the slide here. But here's the way we have, in the United States, we have two different court systems. The first is our states are sovereign entities, right? They were essentially countries before the United States, right? Sort of in that time period. And so the United States sits on top of the states, but is authorized by the states themselves. So we begin with a state court system, and those states have original jurisdiction over everything. So just the way to think about it is, if you commit a crime or if you commit a civil tort, right, by default, you go into state court. And states can set up their courts however they want. Right? I'm not even going to talk about that right now, because circuit system is part of the federal system, which I'm about to explain. So states have original jurisdiction. That's the way it works. But then when we founded the Constitution, the way in which the framers looked at that, they were like, okay, well, here's the problem. Like, I live in the state of Maryland, and suppose I commit a wrong on somebody who lives in Virginia, but that would be tried based on the personal jurisdiction involved. You know, we have an accident in the state of Maryland, so that would go to the Maryland courts. And they had this view, and again, remember, kind of naive person over politics, that would go to the Maryland courts. And their thought process was, well, we don't want that poor Virginian getting homered in a Maryland state court. So they created a federal court system, but that federal court system is one of limited jurisdiction, right? And so basically, in order to get to federal court, you have to get there via, oversimplifying, but you're not lawyers, it's fair. You got to get there by one of two ways. Either you have to violate a federal law or have a claim sounding in the Constitution. That gets you into federal court. Or you have to have a case that would otherwise be in state court, but there is diversity of citizenship, right? The plaintiff is from Maryland and the defendant is from Virginia, and it has to satisfy an amount in controversy requirement so that it's a serious case. It's got to be over 75,000. If either of those two are met, you get to be in federal court instead. And again, the idea was the federal court would be more impartial since it's part of the federal government. Even the federal court in Maryland isn't going to be a homer for Marylanders. It will give that Virginian a fair shake. So those federal courts are geographically, you begin at our trial court level is called the district court for a particular district. And they are geographically dispersed because they sit on top of the state system. So, for example, Maryland has one district court with two divisions. You go to the if you get kicked out of state court, you file or you qualify under the criteria I described, you would file in the U.S. district court for the District of Maryland. Then from there, if you lose in district court, you get one appeal as of right. And that appeal as of right goes to the United States Court of Appeal for a particular circuit. And those are the circuits that were on that map, that slide that I demonstrated, right? And purely geographical. And so what that means is that and then if you lose at the circuit court level, you can petition to our Supreme Court. That is a petition for a writ of certiorari, which means they don't have to take your case, right? They get discretion to grant it, which, you know, you have cert court, so I won't dwell on that. So circuit courts are very often the final word. And what that means is if the Supreme Court hasn't ruled on something, right, if the Fourth Circuit says it's good law, that is law only in the states over which the Fourth Circuit sits. And so another circuit, if you bring a case, if there's a Fourth Circuit case that covers, you know, Maryland, Virginia, West Virginia, and you're in Texas, right, which is under the Fifth Circuit, you could bring a case and say, yeah, this is a matter of first impression. The only court that's ever ruled on this is the Fourth Circuit, and here's why they're wrong. And they don't have to follow it. It's persuasive, but not binding. And then if the Fifth Circuit comes out another way, then one of the major ways in which cases get to our Supreme Court is when there is a conflict among the circuits, right? So a really good illustration of that was our Supreme Court just adjudicated that the Civil Rights Act of 1964, that Title VII's prohibition on discrimination on the basis of sex covered discrimination on the basis of gender identity and sexual orientation. Very, very good decision, if narrow. And they did that because a bunch of the circuits said yes, but a bunch of the circuits said no. So the Supreme Court decides with finality. And then once the Supreme Court decides, all the other circuits have to follow. All the circuits have to follow. So a little CivPro lesson. I love CivPro.
Good and succinct and understandable. Even I understood it. So, because our system seems a lot more simple in comparison. So, just want to draw attention to the fact that there's some interesting chat about QED going on, because of course QED was cancelled this year because of COVID, which is something that Marsh created. There's a website about it. Look it up. So he could maintain his Skeptic of the Year award. And so it'll have to happen in 2021 when he announces that he's got the cure, so he can win again. So this brings us to the final question, at least until we go to the pub, which is, what is your favorite whiskey that doesn't taste like licking a Scottish bog?
Well, I love whiskeys that taste like licking a Scottish bog. So, and I'm gonna plug two like ridiculously peaty ones right first. Which first, if you haven't had the Octomore, that is a challenge, right? That is a Scottish bog invading your taste buds and kicking them into submission. Alternatively, if you like peaty but you're not sure you want the death yet, Ardbeg is all the Ardbegs are fantastic, but they make one called Grooves, which is exactly what it sounds like. They cut these deep grooves on the inside of the barrel to increase the surface area of contact. So it gets like super, it takes on the wood quality, which I enjoy. I mean, you know, again, not all the time. And if you're a purist, I could see why, but like super interesting. What I am drinking here, is my favorite whiskey that does not taste like licking a Scottish bog. It's a good 2 in the afternoon whiskey. And it is called Angel's Envy Rye. Get the rye. Their regular stuff is good. It has a little bit of a sweet quality to it. And I just think it is a delicious. It's my favorite rye, period. So so go ahead and get it. What about you? What are you drinking over there? Is that red wine?
No, I know it looks like red wine. It isn't a red wine glass. No, it's vodka and Diet Coke. Just because I don't have any wine. So good. But we'll continue doing that in the pub. So that was brilliant. So thanks once again to Andrew. If we can have, again, an obscene number of clapping emojis in the chat to show our appreciation.
That was the Skeptics in the Pub online podcast. For more sceptical content, including information about future talks, please like us on Facebook, follow at SITP on Twitter, or head to our website at sitp.online, where you'll also find a link to all the ways you can get in touch with us, including our Discord server. Music in this episode was provided by Thula Bora and used with permission. Until next time, thanks for listening.